Good morning, world. This is the World Labor Hour. Speaking to you from WEFT 90.1, Champaign, Illinois, deep in occupied Alinawek territory. And I'm going to give you Gus now with underwriting.
The Campus Faculty Association at the University of Illinois advocates for academic freedom, shared governance, and a strong faculty voice on campus. CFA is proud to support community radio and the Labor Hour in support of strong unions. You can learn more about the CFA by visiting cfaillinois.org. This hour program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
All right, folks. Excuse me for a moment. I'm looking at the day sheet that tells us what to do. We have given the legal ID, we have done the underwriting, and now it's time to do a show.
Let's do
okay? it. Now, today's show, folks, very sadly, is dedicated to my dear friend and comrade, of probably thousands of people,
yeah,
you know, throughout the country, and definitely in this area. He touched the lives of, basically he touched the lives of millions of even students, yeah, around here in his actions for, educators in this area.
Yeah.
And that is our dear friend, Gene Vanderport, who passed away, was it last Saturday evening?
I believe it was last Saturday, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And we're very, you know, disheartened to hear about that. Gene was responsible for actually bringing a lot of people, including myself, into labor activism.
Yeah.
He is probably one of the major reasons that this radio show exists,
yeah,
as him being a big influence on me and co-founder Peter Miller.
Yeah.
And beyond that, what we're hoping today is that people will stop by the station. You can stop into the studio. I'm sure that if you were a friend of Gene's and ours, you know where we're at.
Exactly.
You can call in on our talk line, which is 359-5438, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Fly live, anyway. It's fly live. And if you don't want to come on the air, we can probably get somebody to the other telephone if you have a comment. And that's 359-9338, mm-hmm, the one where you make pledges twice a year,
yeah,
we hope. And beyond that, if you can find me on Facebook, and that's Bill Gorrell, G-O-R-R-E-L-L, you can send me a personal message, and if we're lucky, I'll notice it while I'm twiddling knobs and pushing, yeah, things and buttons and CDs and all that during the program.
Yeah. You know, this, Bill said it so well, that Gene Vanderport, man, like, one of the first people that I met in engaging in this community. You know, I'm an outsider coming as a graduate student wanting to be involved in scholar activism, you know, not just sitting down writing something, but actually helping the people that I live with and being a part of the community. You know, Gene was one of the individuals that was everywhere I went, you know, no matter where, he was there, engaged, and not just sitting in the back, but he was always at the front with us whenever we were doing anything, all the way up until up until really last week. You know, every time I was somewhere, Gene was there. You know, every time I wasn't somewhere, Gene was there where I wasn't. That's just how he was. He was like almost like the multiple man for those of you that read graphic novels.
Because it's sort of like Tom Joad, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he's everywhere. Wherever. I mean, that's just the kind of person he was. And just like you say, and just besides Weth, I mean, there would be no GEO without Gene Vanderport for some of the work that he did in helping the students organize there. You know, without the GEO, there would be hardly any campus activism at all, because that led to the creation of, you know, the strengthening of the SEIU, the other unions on campus and in the community. So yeah, Gene Vanderport, I believe, is really one of the foundational humans for this area, you know, and he is going to be missed so much.
And for those of you who listen to the show who are unfamiliar with Gene Vanderport, he was a Illinois Education Association UNISERV director, okay? And I think that is the equivalent, say, like in the building trade unions to their business manager.
Exactly.
And if you remember over the last 20 or so years when there were labor disputes going on in Mahomet, I believe Rantoul, Urbana, several surrounding communities, quite often you would see a guy come on talking about it, a really jovial, well-spoken person, but he sounded like a regular person.
Exactly.
And who looked just like Omar Sharif.
That's right.
That was Gene Vanderport. That's right. I tell you, man.
And, but, you know, if it's okay, Bill. No, Belden Fields was one of his dearest friends.
Yes, true.
You know,
they worked together a lot.
For decades.
Socialist Forum.
Yes.
The Socialist Forum.
Yes. And he wrote an amazing piece that went on the Public Eye and also in News Gazette. And I would like to read that piece where he talks about not only Gene's history, but why, you know, like people like me and Belden and others and you know, it's like you said, he was just a very personable person. You could come up to him and he didn't know who I was. You know, he never seen me before. He was already asking me my name, what kind of stuff I like to do. You know, I mean, he really became a friend the first time I met him. So, you know, that's why I think the piece that Belden wrote is really strong. So can I just read it real quick?
Go ahead.
Awesome. So this is from the great Belden Fields, who wrote this piece right after Gene's passing. Quote, "It is difficult to write about an untimely death of someone whom one has known for almost half a century. Gene was my student, my comrade, my friend since the late 1960s. Only a couple of years after my arrival to teach political science at the U of I in 1965, a young, bright-eyed, highly intelligent, and articulate student showed up in one of my classes. It was Gene. He was living in the Danville Collective and driving in to take his classes. The Collective was a group of politically radical young people who were living together at a time when such communes existed all over the country. Gene was a very committed democratic socialist, a socialist in the mold of Gene Debs. Eugene Debs.
Oh, yeah. Big fan of Debs.
Very big,
big
fan.
Big, huge influence, man.
Exactly. He and I, and this is Belden still talking, he and I shared that ideology. While Gene was radical in his politics, he stood out as being more culturally conservative than many of his radical peers in both his dress and his aversion to drugs. Gene was very interested in the idea and practice of worker control over the workplace. So one day he came to me and proposed an independent study course in which he would go to Yugoslavia and observe and interview people who were actually working in factories in which workers were in control. This made Yugoslavia unique among the communist countries in Eastern Europe. I thought this was very gutsy for someone of his age who had never been out of the country before. I agreed to it, and it turned out to be a wonderful broadening experience for Gene. It reinforced his conviction that workers did not just need to be objects in a factory production line as portrayed in, and this is me talking now, one of the greatest films of all time that I will watch every year as long as I live, Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. And if you are listening and you haven't seen that film, go get it right now as we speak.
Yes,
it is to this day, it is over 70 years old and still the best critique of capitalism I have ever seen.
Yes, and by the way, it was an inspiration for Lucille Ball too.
That's
the
right.
Factory scene with the wrenches. Mm-hmm. And Modern Times, I believe, you watch Modern Times, you will know what Fordism is.
Oh yeah, exactly. I mean, it's really just, if you really want to get, and then the best part about it, and I'm going away from Belden for a minute, the best part about the film and why Gene and I had such a great rapport when we talked is that it was very much important about the humanism and the alienation of the human by production and what it did to the body. Showing what happens when the body and the mind mutate, when it's doing repetitive motions, when it's being exploited every single minute of the day. And they use comedy, while be it black comedy, to see what it's doing to society in general. And, you know, and what it's led to today. And it's still relevant. Made in the 1930s and still relevant. So please go on and see that movie. And that's how me and Gene actually connected when we talked about film. But let me go back into Belden right now. So this is Belden continuing his statement. Gene was one of those great student protesters of the 1960s. He opposed the war in Vietnam and the treatment accorded to Cuba by the U.S. government. But he was never just negative. He always envisioned and fought for a democratic socialist future in the States. So leaving Belden for a minute, what Belden is saying is that Gene never took pessimism as a means of understanding capitalism and oppression. He never understood it as being we are just so oppressed that we just can't do anything about it. He always believed in what Marx meant when he said that dialectics, the creation of resistance by the workers, is part of the society. You are oppressed, yes, but it gives you the power to resist and organize yourself, find ways to fight back. Gene was very big in that. So Belden got that right on the hammer right there. That's exactly what he believed in. Now back to Belden. After graduating from the University of Illinois, Gene took a job at the Veterans Administration Hospital in his native Danville. There he became active in the union and rose to his leadership. He was so successful in that role that he was called to the Washington office of the union and sent all over the country as an organizer. Anyone who knows anything about unions knows that the job of a traveling organizer takes an enormous toll on a person's mind and body. So, after a number of years doing that, Gene looked for a position that involved less travel, but also that permitted him to live in a community in which one could develop roots. He looked back home. He took a position as the director of the Illinois Education Association in this area.
Oh, by the way, the Veterans Administration, Gene had a great story about that. I wish I really knew it well. But I don't know, there's some people came in, there was a problem with them. And what they were able to do is get a hold of all the other unions in solidarity in the area, including the police.
That's right.
And the police were actually harassing the people until they got out of the area.
Yeah.
I wish I knew that story. And by the way, if somebody does really know that story, please call in and tell us.
Please, yeah.
That's 359-5438 or 83. It's Fly Live.
Okay? Fly Live. So by getting this job with the IEA, this permitted Gene to be close to his widowed mother who lived in a house in the woods near Danville. They called it the Green Cocoon. While back here, Gene, along with others, including myself, and this is Belden speaking, created the group Socialist Forum. Gene and I are also served as the coordinators of the Living Wage Association of Champaign, which was successful in getting living wage policies adopted in the city of Urbana and Champaign County. Gene was also active in the labor coalition at the University of Illinois, and leaving Belden's voice for a minute, going back to mine, that was one of the first settings where Gene and I got personal, because I would go to those meetings as co-president of the GEO a couple of years ago, and that's when we really developed a good friendship. You know, we will always have these sidebar chats, and that's what I always will remember the most with Gene, is that the conversations that we had in those meetings, you know, both together and also to the sidebar, were very important to me understanding how to organize in this city. Because, like I said, I come from a very demographic and also economically different place in Atlanta to here. So I didn't really understand the mechanics of organizing in this area. And Gene was one of the first ones outside of Sundiata, outside of you and Bill and Dave, you know, just understanding how this city operated so that I can better make use of my abilities.
Yeah, this is like small town.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
And Socialist Forum, of course, that's one of the ways I first met Gene. But by the way, folks, I think we're going to take a short musical break. It's about that time. And I got a little blast from the past. We used to play this every week as it was my theme song. So some of you may want to cover your ears now. But one of the great bands, unfortunately, their songs were being written. After this album, most of their songs were written by a libertarian when they changed drummers. But it's Rush. Oops.
Oh, sorry, folks. Been a little air guitar there.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. The music lives within us.
That's right. And that is an interesting thing about the movie Modern Times that Gus mentioned. And that is it's a somewhat of a silent film, as there is no dialogue at all.
That's right.
But there are, I can't remember, I don't think there's that many sound effects, but there is music and there is audio, people speaking on the giant video screens in the mm-hmm. factory. And at the end of the song, Charlie Chaplin sings a song.
That's right.
So, I mean, you got to see that. It's Modern Times. You know, and yeah, I'm sure you can find it all over YouTube or wherever, you know, and it's fantastic. And like I said, Lucy stole a scene out of that, the scene in the factory where he's bolting things. If you in a episode of Lucy about 20 years later, her and Vivian Vance are trying to work in a chocolate factory and have similar problems.
And now every show from like the late 80s and 90s stole that from Lucy.
Right.
Yeah, because I mean like
this speed up on the line is exactly. what it is. That's, it's a speed up on the line, the assembly line.
And not being able to, because of course for those that haven't seen it, and what it means is that when especially in terms of capitalism, when your production goes up, you know, the worker has to actually exert more labor force, and it's very difficult when the production, when the bosses ask them to do this and that, they can't keep up. So
right.
there are things that happen to the body and the mind that are basically that there's for lack of a better term, the crippling of,
right.
of the mind and body. You know, if you talk to any laborer that has done repetitive motions their entire lives for 30 plus years, they'll tell you what is happening to their bodies and what is happening to their minds in the process. It's very debilitating work for the human.
Yes, that's true. And it's very unrecognized by many people who think that a lot of people haven't made, you know. I mean, I tell you, man, I would have loved the financial security of some kind of factory job like that, but I don't know if I could have emotionally stood,
exactly.
been able to take it, man. I don't know.
Yeah.
Being someplace for 30 years. Wow. And I was talking to a guy actually last week, a person who's a WEFT volunteer, and somebody who is retired from, I'm not going to mention the company, but it is the premier blue collar company perhaps in the United States. And they're represented by what used to be one of the greatest unions in this country.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And this guy, he's only getting $600 a month after his taxes. On his pension, he has $600 a month left to live.
Wow.
On. You know, I don't,
How long did he work?
I don't know the details, but I mean, he was probably there 30 years.
Exactly.
But the thing probably is with, Caterpillar, you have strikes and I remember in the early 1980s and during that really horrible recession, the Reagan recession of that time, Caterpillar workers, walking beans.
Yeah.
And for those of you folks who don't remember walking beans, it's manually going out into the fields, walking all the bean fields and manually cutting the weeds out.
Yeah.
Or in the case of my dad, sometimes pulling them out.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't come back.
Damn.
That's how bad it can be even with a premier blue collar employer. The place where in the 50s, I mean, people moved up from Tennessee and Kentucky. And I'm not talking about like the black migration. There was a huge white migration at that time of people coming up from Tennessee, Kentucky mainly, and getting jobs in these factories in central Illinois. And that's another interesting thing. See, a lot of the people that I came up in the 60s and the 70s were only second generation Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Their parents had come up, and a lot of them, their families went on to basically live off of these companies for another generation until things got bad.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was kind of a ramble on that. I want to know, folks, do any of you shop at Schnucks?
Well, you might want to more.
Yes. Well, if you do, you may want to reconsider that, because Schnucks in St. Louis is planning on moving to a new warehouse operation, lay off 234 Teamsters, and hire through a more or less a third company, more of a temporary agency. All right. And, so the, Teamsters Local 688 and the Teamsters in general are calling for a boycott of Schnucks. And, yesterday they had a day of action in Hampton Village, which is around St. Louis. And, keep that in mind. Perhaps some people could get together and do a picket here.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
And, you know, especially with the Urbana one, because the Urbana store would be, you know, it's a People's Republic of Urbana.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of quote, progressive, liberal, and more radical people in Urbana. So that might be a really good place for an informational picket,
mm-hmm.
you know. I remember when Schnucks first came to this town, that's probably about 20 years ago, there was still a one union grocery store here. It was the Jewel store. And the UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers, had a presence, and they did a lot of informational picketing for quite some time at the Schnucks stores. And later on, they tried to, or maybe about the same time, is when the first Meijer's store opened here, and they had a huge organizing campaign. I think that was before Schnucks. Okay. Yeah, that was before Schnucks. A huge organizing campaign, because Meijer's located that store in this town, because it's one of their first, like, downstate Illinois stores, mm-hmm. and Champaign had a reputation of being a non-union town. You see, like Danville or Decatur might have been a lot tougher.
Oh yeah,
even Bloomington.
Yeah,
and Peoria.
Yeah,
you know,
I can see that. Yeah.
Anyway, that's local things there. And what you got, Gus?
Ooh, in terms of PSAs?
Well, not so much PSAs. Anything?
Oh yeah. Well, it's time for our monthly jobs and income report that we do.
There you go. That's a regular copyrighted feature of,
it is now.
The World Labor Hour.
Very, very much so. I think we started this, about, definitely over a year ago, because I remember doing this on the weekend of the 4th last year too.
Amazing. It's an anniversary.
So we gotta, I think it goes before this though, but, you know, it goes to show you that as long as we follow these patterns, we're gonna be able to organize and give political education to the people about them. So what's been happening recently is that while there has been growth amongst the working poor in terms of our income and our wealth, it has been overtaken drastically by the capitalist class. So let me tell you about what's going on. The economic inequality leapt ahead in 2015 in the U.S., with the average incomes of the top 1% rising twice as fast as the incomes of the rest of us, according to a study released Friday for the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. The top 1% had an average income of $1.4 million last year. $1.4 million last year. By far, the largest growth in incomes came in an even narrower section of the super rich, the top 0.1% of households. Those 1 in 1,000 households saw their incomes rise by nearly 9% to an average of $6.75 million a year. The top 1% increased its share of total U.S. household income from 21.4% to 22%. The top 10% collected more than half of all U.S. household income. Let me read that to you again, listeners, because I'm not making this up. The top 10% collected more than half of all U.S. household income in the United States, 50.5%. And this number is up from an even 50% in 2014. So they are getting, so not only is wealth not being distributed to the proper places where it needs to be going to, wealth is actually being seized more fiercely, more fiercely by the top 1%. These figures are based on an analysis of tax data by Emmanuel Saez, an economics professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who was well known for his great research into income and wealth inequality. The data from the Internal Revenue Service gives a more accurate picture of the growth of income inequality than U.S. Census data, which excludes capital gains and other sources of non-wage income, which go almost entirely to the wealthy.
Right.
So the year 2015 was unusual compared to the rest of the period since the 2008 financial crash, and that the wealthy, now this is important, everybody, the wealthy in 2015 did not monopolize all of the gains in real income. Average income for the bottom 99% rose by 3.9% to $48,000 a year, the biggest annual increase since 1998, but only half the rate of increase enjoyed by the top 1%. This still left the bottom 99% of U.S. families below the level of 2007 when the recession first started. So, you know, this is what Sayers is saying is that at the same time, top incomes grow even faster, leading to a furthering gap of inequality. And this is something we talked about a couple of weeks ago on the show when there was an international report of the same trend happening, that you do see some growth in the working poor in terms of their income, but the top 1% in other countries as well, their growth is so much more exponential. That it's just swallowing the working class whole. So this is a trend that this is alarming.
Yeah, we have a correspondent who writes, that's why it's a good idea to have laws calling for a limit on how many times the top paid guy can earn, compared to the lowest paid. This person believes that Japan now has such a law. I'm not sure about that, considering the society, it may very well be
Yeah.
Because the Japanese, well, this gets into cultural theory, but the Japanese are the tightest people in the world in terms of being close together and supporting each other. Mm. It's what
looking at their history, especially following World War II, you know, there's so much to talk about.
And oh, by the way, on this scale, the Americans are the worst.
Oh yeah,
and
definitely.
Europeans are somewhere in between.
Oh yeah, definitely.
It's called the contextual scale. See, in Japan, everybody is so similar that you don't have to say very many words, use as many words as you do somewhere like in the United States, where our experiences are so varied that I cannot assume that you will know exactly what I'm talking about unless I describe it pretty well. Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. But in a related thing, and this is from a story from The Guardian, and it's about Oxfam, and it's actually from January, and the headline is "The Richest 62 People as Wealthy as Half of the World's Population." Mm-hmm. And this is wealth, not income.
Exactly.
Another side of another way to look at things. And what's really interesting here is they have a chart, a graph, and it shows in 2010, it took 388 of the richest people to equal the poorest half of the world's population. 2011, that split in about half down to 177. 2012, 159, 2013, 92, 2014, 80, 2015, it takes only 62 people to have as much wealth as the lower half of the entire global, population.
A lot, and you know what's funny about this is that there's really no discussion about this anywhere, and it's, what it is it's the trend of what late capital does, is that it consolidates the wealth into an even smaller group of people, to where you have people falling out of classes. You have people falling out of the capitalist class, people who own land and own production. There's less and less of them.
And it's more financial.
Exactly. It's more financial now. And a lot of it has to do with the internet. Now that you can network capital across spaces, across the oceans, because of the internet, it makes it so much easier to monopolize and consolidate that power.
Yes. Well, it also makes it a lot easier to go to, what's the name of that website? Silk Road, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Which maybe that's not it, but it's a Chinese website where basically you can find items that are maybe already manufactured and sort of have your logo slapped on them, mm-hmm. and get them incredibly cheap and bring them back to you. I mean, it's easy enough for an individual to do on a fairly small scale. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I think this is happening somewhat in the, something I'm more familiar with, the guitar business. Mm. They have what are called Gibsons. And the Gibson guitar, I mean, is the guitar, man.
Yeah. It always has been. The Gibson Les Paul is like the holy grail of guitars.
Okay.
And what happens is in China, you know, using CNC machines, and there are skilled people in China too, they make these copies of these Les Pauls that in the United States you might have to pay up to $5,000 for, and you can pick them up for like $200 or $300.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, people are doing that and they get caught sometimes, but it's amazing. But that's really getting off track.
No, but that's what we see happening is that there is a means to what, to how, and this is something that the neoliberal theory, and that's why it's so important to understand there's a difference between neoliberal theory and the process of neoliberalization, is that in neoliberal theory is this idea that you can, the most independence you can have is to be able to compete and have free market. To be able to own whatever you want. And that includes, unfortunately, when you get to the process of neoliberalization, you have to own people's time. You have to become a totalitarian type state. You have to own every single minute of the day for everybody, or else it'll mess up how late capital works. You can't have too many people who have the ability to own capital. Otherwise, it will totally destroy the system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, on something a little bit more of a, just a little hard news thing here. And I love the name of this blog, Sternberger with Fries. And Sternberger, if y'all remember Sternberger. Andy Stern, who, by the way, I was just reading a description of a new book that he's got out that describes the new gig economy and how unions are some, are just, have no, anyway, but I'll get back to this. Last week, approximately 900 corrections officers in Fresno County, California voted to leave SEIU local, Service Employees International Union local 521 and join an independent union, according to media reports. The corrections officers, who've been members of local 521 for many years, are employed at the Fresno County Sheriff's Office and Probation Office. Here are the vote totals from last week's vote. Fresno County Public Safety Association, the new independent union, 315 officers or employees wanted that, and SEIU Local 521, only 234. Okay, Local 521 represents approximately 31,000 public sector workers in the central part of Illinois. Almost a year ago, the same group of corrections officers also voted to leave Local 521. However, the election results were subsequently tossed out after Local 521 filed legal challenges because election officials inadvertently sent the mail-in ballots to voters some 4 days early. In a separate development, more than 300 members of Local 521 near San Jose, California, are planning to decertify SEIU, according to Morgan Hill Times. That effort is being led by the chapter president for Local 521, who said she resigned her position at SEIU in, resigned her position.
Wow.
And you know, and she's probably getting some decent money, you know, in order to lead the decertification effort. Oh, wait a minute. She said she was a chapter president, so they probably, is that? I don't know if that's a staff position.
Oh, it depends on that local.
Yeah. But anyway, she and her coworkers wanted to join a different union or form an independent union among themselves. Here's a quote from her. We pay $130,000 per year in union dues to SEIU San Jose and feel that we don't get any representation in the exchange. This has been coming for a while.
Yeah.
And this is just in a long pattern
That's
of
right.
West Coast SEIU locals and whatever organizations seceding from the SEIU.
Yeah.
And I remember, what was that battle? Oh, it went on for years in San Francisco, and slates were elected, and then there would be trusteeships, you know, the international come in and take over. I mean, this has been going on for a long time. All this stuff started under the Andy Stern, which is why this is called, Sternberger with Fries is the name of this blog. But on the other hand, the SEIU is doing some groundbreaking work supporting fast food workers in the fight for 15.
Yeah, but the thing is that, you know, this kind of goes in what we're always talking about, is that when you look at the real day-to-day between the relationship of the international and the local,
yeah,
and what's going on. I mean, with the same problem with the AFL-CIO, You know, there's gonna, I mean, there's something, you know, AFT as well. There's something inherently wrong with the way the union right. is structured and the relationships. Because like I said, I see this stuff all the time in the South. A lot of my research looks at where these workers were asking, I mean, we pay these dues. Yeah, we should be getting support. When we have troubles, when we have grievances, the international is nowhere to be found. So they decertify or they break away and form their own unions. That, I mean, it happens all the time. And until we have a more workerist structure of the union, then it's going to continue. We can't continue to allow these corporate entities that are, and again, I agree with you. They are having a great campaign for the Fight for 15. The Fight for 15 is excellent, but let's not forget that it's not the SEIU the staffers, the $500,000 a year people that are doing all this work. It's the workers on the ground. It's the, you know, it's the Aaron Ammons. It's the Justice for Titles.
Yeah.
Those everyday workers for SEIU that are coming out to the fast food pickets. So I think that's why the Fight for 15 is so strong, is that the rank and file are out there pushing
right.
it every day.
Yeah, and it also goes to show too, I do want to say, is there's good parts of unions and bad parts of unions.
Exactly.
You see, I mean,
that's the great point. It's just something we gotta deal with, you know, we gotta fix quickly.
I need to fix something. I'm dropping stuff on the floor.
Oops.
And I'm fixing to maybe do some PSAs here.
Okay.
Get a little Chitlins Con Carne cranked up. This is from the old days. This is from the original thing. Peter Miller picked this song out.
Oh, okay.
It's a Stevie Ray Vaughan version of Kenny Burrell's Chitlins Con Carne, featuring guitar octaves. Okay. All right, folks. Does your organization have an upcoming fundraiser or provide service to the community? Are you part of an upcoming music or art event? How about a workshop or educational seminar? Send a short script to PSA@weft.org to be included in our on-air public service announcements. You can also drop off a flyer at the station or mail it to WEFT 113 North Market Street, Champaign, Illinois 61820. And by the way, I just love getting meta with PSA there, a PSA about PSAs.
Yeah, we need more of that.
That's right, folks. This is your community radio station, and I'm randomly pulling one out of the art and music column. Folk and Roots Friday has returned for the summer to the Lake House in Crystal Lake Park and 206 West Park in Urbana. On Fridays over the summer, hear local performers in the Americana, folk, and roots genres for free. This event is co-sponsored by the CU Folk and Roots Festival. Call 217-367-1544 for more information. And there's some handwritten here. It's the first and third Fridays, June through August. And you can find out more at folkandroots.org. But that sounds like a pretty cool thing. Maybe there'll be somebody out there playing some labor music.
Definitely. I mean, you know that the local talent here in regards to art, you know, where
maybe Jim Imean will be there. Could be. That's the kind of thing he does. He ought to do that.
That's
true. If you're not thinking about it, Jim, think about it.
Yeah.
Play. Get out there and play, man. We love it. Now, here's something here. Might be good for you. This is out of the community service column. The Audiology Clinic at the University of Illinois is offering free hearing screenings June 1st, 2016 through July 22nd, 2016. Screenings appointments may be scheduled by calling 217-333-2230. The Audiology Clinic is located at 901 South 6th Street in Champaign on the southwest corner of 6th and Daniel Streets. Parking is available at designated meter spaces in the adjacent south lot. All right, folks. Well, there's a lot of stuff going on in this community, and there's a lot of good things, and this is something that could be really good for some low-income people.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, getting that free checkup on your ears.
You got to. Yeah. Anytime that you have a chance to get any type of free medical care in this country, I mean, it's really like a lifesaver at all costs. Please go out.
And here we got another thing coming up here. This is the Splish Splash Water Safety Bash. will be held at Sholem Aquatic Center at 225 Sangamon Drive in Champaign on July 4th. By the way, I spent 6 months building that place.
Really?
Yeah, it's amazing, man. You wouldn't believe what it takes to put a lazy river in somewhere.
Man,
wow. It's like there was semis of rock coming in day after day after day, man. Underneath that lazy river is like several feet of white rock that's got a bunch of pipes running through it. When you look at the bottom of the lazy river, you can see the holes where the pipe, there's like a half a dozen of them. Well, and that pushes all the water to make it move.
Yeah, wow.
And, it's just pretty amazing what it goes. I mean, that's one of the things I've really last several years gotten into, not so much environmentalism, but just worry about how much things are being taken up in the world. And I work on these construction jobs and it just blows my mind, even in this town on these relatively small projects, just the amount of material involved.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just keep thinking, we can't sustain this.
No, we can't.
You know?
And that's why I keep telling folks, like, the only way there's going to be substantial, like, growth in relation to the environment is that the capitalist class has to reduce their production. Plain and simple. They're going to have to get rid of what they're doing, because like you say, we can't sustain it from an earth standpoint. There's no way to sustain these types of resources in building late capital. It's just, it can't happen. Otherwise we're going to see a major collapse that's going to be like detrimental, even though they got all those ridiculous world ending movies out now. There's been like 20 of them. And then the Independence Day just came out last week that shows like the earth, like basically being destroyed by aliens.
It's again?
Like, again, yeah. They came back after 20 years after the first one.
A generation later.
But yeah, so I mean, just in that sense that, yeah, we got to really start thinking, like, we have to understand that what's happening to the earth, we can't sustain that type of production and those types of materials and what it does to the earth to take all that, to make all this stuff, to make all this wealth for this 1%. It's hurting the earth.
Well,
it's hurting us.
Well, when I'm thinking environmentally, you know, anarchism may be not just inevitable, but necessary. Where we drop down into much more decentralized societies, smaller, more sustainable communities running on probably mainly wind and solar power as much as possible. We're creating larger federations, and these would be voluntarily aggregated groups doing what we need to do to live.
So we're talking Mad Max World Warrior type?
No, I'm talking not at all, but a much more cooperative thing, okay. You know. But no, you know, the usual, I mean, basically an anarcho-syndicalist type thing that's very decentralized,
exactly.
and run in federations rather than hierarchies.
Exactly.
And where the goal is for people, all people, just to have a decent life and not for just a few people to have some incredible bizarre wealth that they could never fully enjoy over hundreds of generations, or, you know,
that 1% is going to suffer as well.
Wow. Yeah, they think
it's just us, but it's going to affect them too.
That's right, man. I mean, they got to have a planet.
Every living being is going to be affected. And you know what? People need to open their eyes and see this stuff. I mean, they're not just showing us these movies for no reason. They're really showing us what's going on. And,
all
the different things they're doing into the earth.
I mean, the thing is, what's interesting is that we talked about this when these capitalists, when they go outside of the function of capital and they start working as individuals instead of maintaining the system itself, and they start doing those things where they're intensifying their production and what they're doing to the humans and the earth. You know, like you say, they're gonna suffer for it. They're gonna be a part. They're gonna be a
breaking news. Yeah. Dave Johnson back from vacation.
Oh wow!
Hey, okay, folks. Now that Dave's here, let's get back to Gene a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
Because I want to tell my story of Gene.
Okay.
All right.
I know Dave has some too.
Okay. Well, here's how I met Gene. First, a few years before I met Gene, I went to graduate school with his son at Illinois State. And this was in the 1980s. I was not involved at all in labor stuff. I was been a member of the laborers union for about 10 years, but I was not interested in labor issues at all. Gene told me, or Dave told me, that his dad was a union organizer, and I was like, wow, that's something else. I didn't even know they existed anymore. So anyway, years late, a few years after that, because of my wonderful education from Illinois State, I'm still working in the building as a laborer, and I heard about a big rally that was going to happen in Decatur, something about workers at the Staley plant there. And so I went over there with my camera mainly to build my photo portfolio. And at that day, I met Ann Feeney. Well, actually, but first what happened was I went to the Kay's merchandise store to buy a lens. And I ran into some people from St. Louis there that had Labor Vision shirts on. And so I started talking to them and told them I was from around Champaign. And they told me that, well, one of the people I need to talk to is Gene Vanderport. You know, so then I went on to the rally and did a lot of photography and met Ann Feeney there, our dear friend, who, by the way, just celebrated her 65th birthday. I think it was yesterday or the day before. And some other people, and that's when the great pepper gassing happened. Is this incident where a bunch of people, including Gene Vanderport, several people from Champaign that I got to become very good friends with later, also a guy who I knew from childhood, who was a member of my union local, who just happened to know a lot of people who worked at Caterpillar, so they told him about this thing, and he came up there. And anyway, what happened was their whole goal was to cross this gold line at the West Gate, okay, and that was the property line. All right, and all these people were standing holding hands, and there's great videos on this, and you can see them walking backwards, and there's a line of cops behind them. And you see a guy in a red cap lose his balance because he is probably about half drunk and trip and fall backwards into the line of the cops. Then the cops go berserk and start pulling out pepper gas and spraying everybody all over the place. But I was back away from it, actually talking to Ann Feeney. And while, and caught a few pictures of this stuff going on. And then after that, the Labor Vision people had given me Gene's phone number. I called Gene up. We met at Arby's there on Cunningham Avenue in Urbana. He, introduced himself to me and he goes, okay, now I'm going to tell you something. You might want to join the Socialist Forum. Socialist. And remember, folks, this is like, 1990. One or two or something like that. You know, I can't remember now exactly. And, so anyway, I started joining the Socialist Forum, met a whole bunch of other people, including Belden Fields, that Gus was quoting earlier in the show. I was involved in WEFT anyway, met Peter Miller, another person greatly influenced by Gene Vanderport. And he said he wanted to do a labor show because of what was happening in Decatur. And I said, well, I'll help you out every once in a while. Well, Peter's in New Hampshire, and I'm here. Okay. So that was it. I went to a lot of Socialist Forum meetings, worked on a lot of stuff with them. Seen Gene. God, I don't know how many pictures I've taken of people like Gene and Jermaine Light, his wife, yeah. Jim Barrett. You know, yeah. And Belden and all of these people, I at demonstration after demonstration for years and years and years. Yeah. And I know Gene, he helped Peter Miller. He got Peter Miller started in his career as a NEA person. Mm-hmm. He's now NHEA in New Hampshire. Another Dan, Chambers, another friend of ours. An ex-GEO guy,
yeah.
Who's now a NEA person. I can't remember where he's at now. God, I don't know how many other people, yeah. You know, could have stories like that. And I'm sure Dave might have one here.
Well, Bill, you know, we weren't going to be getting back in town until 3 o'clock today. But for some strange reason, both my wife and I woke up at 4:30 a.m. wide awake in Nashville, where we spent the night.
Oh,
wow.
And it was almost providence, because right at about 11:01, we get to Mattoon. And I'm thinking, you know, the radio, Labor Hour might be in range, and we turned it on, sure enough.
Wow, you can hear us in Mattoon. Hello, Mattoon! Yeah.
So I got to hear, you know, most of the show until, of course, we pulled in. I had to, you know, take some stuff in the house real quick, get my keys, run over here real quick, because I heard you talking. You know, this was really great stories. I mean, I thought that was really an inspiring story you were talking about, Gus, about when you first met Gene and everything.
Yeah.
And I know you guys were talking about the incident, or the labor action, I should say, at the VA hospital.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what was that? It's a really good story.
Yeah, it is. They had a non-union construction crew come in.
Oh, that's what it was. Okay.
Work. So the second day they were there, okay, they were going to be remodeling this one area of the Veterans Administration hospital. So they get there, and it's really strange because there's no staff anywhere. It turns out there was a special called union meeting at the far end of the building, I guess, away from where they were working. And when they went to go unlock, try to go into other areas, all the doors were locked except one door, which was to the ward where the mentally disturbed patients were housed. And then next thing, there's all these patients from that ward wandering around in their work areas, and it kind of produced a little bit of a mayhem, if you will.
Oh, wow.
They didn't know what to do because there's all these mentally disturbed people walking around and picking up tools and all sorts of other things.
Hey,
and,
Dave.
Yes.
I'm going to interrupt this right now for Radio Free America.
Okay.
For the podcast. We'll be right back with the rest of this story. No, it's a great story.
Okay.
Thanks, folks.
Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever, and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they've tortured and scared you for 20-odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. To be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
Well, folks, that was John Lennon, Working Class Hero, a song that I think really, at least the title describes Gene. Some of the song is a little bit cynical about our brothers and sisters, but Anyway, Dave, we ended the second half hour with Dave telling a really good story about Gene Vanderport when Gene was working at the VA hospital in Danville, Illinois, as some of us like to call Dantucky. And Dave's cringing. Hey, we got Rantucky and Clintucky, too. I was working in Clintucky recently. And anyway, while they were working there, there was a non-union contractor came in to do some work, and Gene decided, I guess, that it's time to give them a few problems. Dave, what did he do?
Well, indeed, as I was saying, basically the staff disappeared. The doors to the ward where the mentally disturbed patients were was left open. These patients wandered into the work area, were picking up these workers' tools, and you know, just just created a case of mayhem. And these guys didn't know what to do. All the other doors were locked. There was no staff. The only door that was left open had to go through the psychiatric ward and then out side. And when they got outside, I guess they found that surprisingly enough, that the Danville police were there, and they said that there was basically they got some calls of complaints of these workers causing disturbances at the VA hospital, and that they were basically going to escort them out of town until this got resolved. So they basically made them get in their company trucks, and which is, I mean, this is unheard of.
For their own protection.
Yeah. This is unheard of. I mean, for the police to do something like this. I mean,
that just shows you Gene.
Yeah.
Man,
he was able to
actually.
And this is the thing is, I mean, you talk about a direct action, a solidarity action. Mm-hmm. I mean, only Gene could have pulled off something like, or very few people like Gene could have pulled off something like this.
Well, you know? And it goes way back. You know, Gene's family, you know, were union people. Westville. You know, the Danville area in general, much more union than say Champaign.
Yeah.
Admiration for Eugene Debs, who's, Terre Haute's not that far from Danville.
Yeah.
In fact, and I believe that, Gene had relatives who personally knew Debs, and, Debs would come and speak, you know, various places, in that area. Gene, when he was 15 years old, was a rock musician, a keyboard player, had a band. I forget the name of it right now. But anyway, they decided that him and his rock buddies decided that they ought to join the musicians union and make the same as the other musicians in town. Mm-hmm. And when they did that, you know what the scale was? And this is at what, 1965?
Yeah, early 60s.
The scale was $15 an hour. Yeah, so Gene had his own Fight for 15 campaign a long time ago.
Yeah, that'd be almost $60 an hour in today's money.
Oh, that'd be more than that. Yeah, and, but you got to remember, folks, musicians, like educators, get paid for a lot of the time when they're not actually educating or playing.
Indeed.
Educators, they have to plan their stuff. Mm-hmm. Musicians and other artists have to practice. You know, how many hours goes into 1 hour of that performance?
Yeah, you know, Bill, I also met, the first time I met Gene was at a socialist forum meeting. You and Peter Miller, talked me to go into one of their meetings.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was like when I came on, it was during the Carpenters Rebellion. You guys, had me on as an occasional guest to talk about what was going on both locally and in central Illinois and nationally in our rebellion. And you go, hey, you want to, you know, go check this out? And I remember going to the meeting and there was like 30 or 40 people there. And for some reason, Gene just stood out. There was something about him. I mean, just kind of his down to earth. He just made you feel comfortable.
Well, and
you know?
He's so energy too.
And plus his knowledge, his energy and his witty humor, you know, lighthearted witty humor, you know, it was just everything about him. I mean, he always just kind of stood out in the crowd, you know,
besides
looking like Omar Sharif, which by the way, my wife Heidi really, thinks she always thought the same thing and wanted to say it to anybody, but, especially when he was younger and, you know, but, you know, there's another great story about Gene.
Those old people who remember who Omar Sharif
is. Indeed.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. These old movies, you know, modern times. I think that was really, really interesting, Gus, how you're talking about that besides, you know, meeting Gene and, kind of make a connection, you know, with union issues that you kind of got a personal connection to that film, Modern Times.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting because there are always points to where you're trying to learn, you know, I'm trying to read and understand how the system works, how we can resist, how we can organize it. And one of the biggest things that really he was a major contributor for me understanding is the idea of object versus subject. If you're objectified by the system, which is what Chaplin was making a satire about, then you have no agency. You know, like there has to be something there. So when you become a subject, then you have agency. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that I really couldn't grasp yet until people like he and Belden, Sundiata, my advisor, others that I talked to and helped me understand how this works. So, like I said, he was just so legendary in being able to have those conversations mm-hmm. with everyday people about, no, this is what this means. This is why we have to fight. That was his big thing, is that there's always a way to fight and win.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And, you know, the other thing about Gene, I mean, another thing he did besides the living wage campaign was that he helped change the system in the city of Urbana of how school board members are elected.
Oh.
It used to be at large. So what you had was, for going back forever, you had basically the entire Urbana school board being elected from a 6-square block area.
Mm.
And he basically started a campaign, got me involved in it. I didn't know him very long, and got a lot of the people involved in it, including, of course, teachers and others in the education community, and was able to get a ballot initiative and actually was able to change that system. And believe me, there was a lot of resistance to that by the powers that be. Yeah. And he got it changed to where now, every section of the city, you know, is divided up into certain geographical sections and wards, are guaranteed they're going to get somebody from their neighborhood, from their area, right, to represent them on a school board, which I think is very important.
Of course, know? Very important. Yeah. Yeah.
And here's the thing about Gene too, is that when he came on as UNISERV director for the IEA Teachers Union, in this area they only represented teachers at that time. And for years, Gene pushed the state IEA to organize the support staff.
I mean, we're talking about
bus drivers, cooks, secretaries, maintenance people, IT people. You know, everybody that works in the schools that makes the schools run, in addition to the teachers.
And you know why I think that's significant?
Why?
Because of the general attitude of the NEA in not being like a trade union,
yes, mm-hmm,
where they are a professional organization.
Correct.
And
correct.
Gene broke that wall down.
Yes, there. And he didn't wait around for approval, by the way.
That's right.
He went and started organizing the workers anyway. You know?
That's right.
And I mean, before they actually formed the union, he already had them organized by the time he finally got his approvals, you know, a year or two later. You know? And
it's easier to get forgiveness than it is permission.
Indeed. very well said, Bill. Very well said. You know, and we as activists, you know, and people that are concerned about, you know, where this world's heading and it's even getting worse, is, you know, we don't have time for such, you know, for such naive sentimentalities. So we got to do what we need to do.
That's right.
You know, and Gene was typical of that. But short time after that, I guess, three people ran for school board in Champaign. Two millionaires and an ex-principal of Centennial High School, who's a very right-wing individual, spent an unprecedented amount of money to get elected. I mean, it's the first time I ever remember, anyone else remembers, we're here in Champaign. Urbana school board members paid to have billboards all over the city. Well, they narrowly got elected.
Wow.
And they started to try to change the whole textbooks in the schools, and then they basically talked about charter schools and eventually getting the unions to what they said is bring the unions in to heal, because they were just out of line as
to
far
heal.
As their money. And so the first thing they tried to bring in somebody from the Edison
Project. Predator union,
yes.
Super predator union.
The school board brought in somebody from the Edison Project, which is one of the oldest charter schools, private corporate charter schools. And I guess they were going to speak at the school board meeting one night. Well, when the limousine pulled up with the charter school representatives, Gene was out there with 200 people from the community, and I guess the limousine slowed down and then just took off. I mean, never did this.
And they're all there with pitchforks.
Short time later, the contract comes up for renewal for the support staff. And they're talking about bringing in, you know, they got a new superintendent from Texas who, happened to be connected to the Bush crime family down in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
He had a history of supposed successes. Supposedly, you know, the dropout rate went from, 28% down to, less than 1%. Well, it's turned out they just expelled the students before.
That's what they do in Southern school systems.
Yeah, you probably had experienced that in Atlanta.
Yes, we did.
So anyway, they wanted to play real hardball. So Gene saw it coming. He saw it coming. I mean, a year before the contract was up. So he went around and talked to all the members in the bargaining team one-on-one. Gene was really good at this. He would basically go, he would make an effort to go to every single bargaining unit in every single school at least once a month, and he'd bring pizza along, and have, basically, luncheons with the, workers there to find out what's going on. You know, he wanted to know what's going on. He wanted to get their advice and see if there's any problems. And at this point, he was telling them what was going to be coming down, that they might have to go out and strike, and wanted to know what was, you know, and he needed information from them, what was going on in their area. So basically, long story short, Gene, over the course of a year, wove this very intricate weave all around the school board. And when they came time to try to play hardball, they couldn't move. He had them outflanked on publicity. He had outflanked as far as certifications. I mean, it got so bad to when it came down to the day, but actually it was the, 10 minutes before midnight when the strike was going to start, the superintendent they brought from Texas, who was supposed to be such a hard nose person, actually broke down and cried and begged the school board to do the contract, because otherwise it was going to be total.
Well, you know what? Sounds to me like somebody over at the history department, or that's into labor history, maybe should do a study of Gene's career. And tease these things out. You know, devise a strategy.
Another thing about Gene is he knew so many famous people. It just amazed me. He knew Stan Weir, the one who was a former West Coast longshoreman who wrote the book Single Jack Solidarity, who actually was a professor of the Labor Institute for a while. He knew people. He actually met Fred Hampton a couple times. He knew Bobby Seale and Bobby Rush, the Black Panthers of Chicago. He knew Tom Hayden.
Well, he worked for Jesse Jackson too.
Yeah, and also, you know, the thing is, he met these people when he was in college, when he was an SDS, and he was constantly going up to Chicago all the time.
Yeah.
When the things were going on, I mean, we're talking the period of 67 to roughly 71.
Because he got here in 66.
Yeah.
And yeah,
fall 66.
Yeah, 66, and then he was everywhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, and there's so much, but let's put this way, I wasn't even planning to be back today, but we got up early, and I think by some stroke, I think it was fate. I think for some reason my wife and I just woke up this morning, and I heard you guys on the radio. I just had to come down and at least share a couple of my Gene stories, because man, I tell you, he was a great friend, great comrade, and I mean, we're all going to miss him, and I think the communities in general is going to miss him as well.
Well, folks, I think on that note, we'll take a little music break and come back.
Okay, guys, well, I'm sorry.
The high privilege and the distinct honor to present to you the President of the United States.
Thank you all very much. Thanks for the warm welcome. Let's roll. 1, 2, 3, 4. Imagine, there's no heaven, heaven, heaven. It's easy. If you try, no hell.
Below
us, and above us, only sky. Imagine all the people, living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It is not hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. And no religion too. It's a good idea. Imagine all the people living side by side. Peace. You can say, I am a dreamer. But I'm not the only one, and I hope someday you'll join me, and the world will live as 1, 2, 3, 4. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. Brotherhood of man. All the people sharing all the world. Imagine. Thank you very much. Peace. We strive for peace. Let's come together.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Imagine.
with peace.
A chance. Let's come together. All I'm saying is give peace a chance. Give peace a chance. Imagine.
All the handouts, the bribery, the police, all the fucking hype, you know?
We seek peace.
All mass destruction. All mass destruction. All mass destruction.
Well, folks, that's kind of a blast from the past. It's called Imagine This, and it's a good old W there. His voice was being manipulated.
W.
Yeah, I got all this stuff from back in the Bush era.
Yeah.
You know, because it was just so easy.
It really was. I mean, it was everywhere too. I mean, there were like six cartoon shows. Regular shows about him. I mean, like, there was so much out there.
Oh, that's my Bush.
That's my Bush.
Did you see that?
Yep. I remember that one.
That was great. I mean, that was more really making fun of sitcoms than it was George Bush.
Yeah, but.
It's like he had the nosy neighbor next door.
Yeah. I mean, even Will Ferrell is like a Broadway star now for playing W on stage across the world. I mean, it's just that kind. George W. Bush is just this huge caricature of the problem of American federal government, and he's just been displayed that way since he's been president. It's really interesting how that exploded in our culture.
Wow, the guy, the ex-alcoholic you'd want to have a beer with, huh?
Don't let him babysit your grandkids.
Oh.
But, you know, here's the thing, though. Just think. Now, having a beer with George W. Bush or with John Kerry, okay?
Oof.
Now, here's the deal. Now, John Kerry, don't you think he'd have a lot more interesting war stories than George Bush?
No, when Kerry talks, though, you really want to fall asleep. but Bush, you know, Bush is kind of untamed in his speech. You know, like, they had to check him a couple of times because he was about to go out there. But so yeah, but talking to Bush would be a lot more interesting than talking to Kerry because number one, it's like you got to listen to the train wreck happen as it comes out of his mouth. But you know, so it's just, and also another fun fact too that I found out about when he was president, that every day he had to have a Cheeto sandwich.
A Cheetos sandwich.
That he would order, that he could not do work without, like, I believe it was either ham or bologna, and then he had to put a bunch of Cheetos on the sandwich and eat it every day. And that was like a requirement for him to do work while he was president.
Okay.
Not made up either.
Yes. Well, I prefer that my presidents not be so entertaining.
Yeah.
And, Bush, I don't know. He was off the reservation. I think he did. I don't know. And we have a similar thing now, even more outrageous.
Yeah, of course.
With Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And I really think that Donald Trump is got some kind of dementia issues going on.
Yeah, it's and definitely.
You know, because he doesn't seem like he has. His thoughts are not connected at all. No, I don't know.
Because he's not a politician. See, that's the thing about Donald Trump, that's how Reagan was able to gain popularity after being an actor for so long, is that he actually went into politics before he decided to take the big jump to the presidency. And when you have these business, see, that's the problem with capitalists and politics. Capitalists are not taught to respect and listen to people and able to make coherent ideas appealing to
people.
They don't
think they need to.
Yeah, exactly. They don't need to. I don't have to appeal to these people. That's not what I have to do. So he's having trouble maintaining a consistent tone of appealing language for people to listen to whatever he has to say. So he'll throw out some crazy stuff, and 1% out of the crazy stuff is appealing to the people, and that's not going to work. And that's why, and that's what I'm saying. That's what other people who were not politicians, they had to learn to do before they became politicians. But like you say, I think you're right. I think that there's something wrong up there, because he has a very bad disdain for people. Because when you see him talk to people, he talks to them, down to them. He doesn't actually engage in conversations with people. And that,
I don't know if you saw this clip, but there's this came out maybe a couple of months ago, and I can't remember where it was, but he was giving a speech somewhere, and after the speech, he was kind of shaking hands with people, and there was an African American man there, a supporter, who was just, you know, like the look on his face. Yeah, come here and shake my hand. And Trump was just so obviously, completely, willfully ignoring this man. It was so obvious. And after this guy, he finally realized, and the look on his face, he was just so crestfallen. When he realized that Trump was just completely ignoring him.
So he was one of the people that was, when we heard Trump say, the blacks love me. He was one of the ones that came out and said, yeah, maybe he does love us. Maybe we should go to his rally.
Well, and that was a few weeks before the recent thing where he says, yeah, see that black over there?
Yeah.
he likes me.
Yeah, the blacks love me. Man,
it's always
guy.
The love me.
Yeah.
It's not like Japanese people love me. The Japanese people love me.
Yeah. Like, and I think you're right in the sense that when you actually, that's why I'm really like, these next few months of him debating Clinton and all this stuff, hearing his sound bites, they're going to be so irritating and jarring, because like you say, he has no respect for people. And when he talks to them, he talks to people like they're objects, like they're not even humans.
Right. Well, and then we had somebody write in. Don't forget the blatant discourtesy to the disabled journalist where he mocked that.
Wow.
I mean, that was terrible.
Oh.
Right there. The entire crowd should have turned their back on him and walked out.
Yeah.
That just shows you how awful those people are who are
bad.
In his crowd. I just cannot abide by the mocking of disabled people like that.
Exactly.
At least since I was 10 years old. That's his level of maturity.
Exactly.
And then he turns around, everybody's like, oh, he says it like it is, he tells the truth, but no, he comes back around. Well, no, I wasn't mocking him.
He hasn't told, that's the thing I love when you hear people talk about why they support Trump, is that he tells it like it is. He has never told the truth about anything. All of his data has been proven to be false. Whatever data he ever spits out. And when he gives speeches, when you actually go and look at the stuff he's saying, none of that stuff is accurate.
Well,
he
and
just throws out generalizations.
It's the exact same thing people were saying about George Wallace.
Yeah.
That's, I remember hearing it specifically from the mouth of working class Democrats when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Well, at least George Wallace says, you know, says what I think.
But you know what that's coming out of back then. There was still a heavy dose of Dixiecrat that was still heavily in that party though.
Right.
So,
well,
yeah.
that's right. Yeah. Right then that was like the, I'm thinking probably 1972. The 1972 election.
Yeah.
I can remember the specific person I was hearing say that too. The mother of, some neighbors of mine.
Yeah.
And it's just, and for people who don't remember, for you younger people out there, George Wallace was somebody who once ran for office, and he actually was kind of a racial moderate when he started out.
He was actually, yeah.
And he got beat by some guy, and he said, well, I'm not going to be out N-worded again.
That's right.
And so basically, he might have been really playing a big act for a long time.
Oh, he definitely was.
And then after he kind of got out of politics, he did become sort of a... maybe sort of an avuncular figure. I don't know.
Yeah, because he got, he lost that first race and it was really bad. And then, the stuff that he was talking about, if you read some of his early speeches, the Klansman stuff he started talking when he was running for the governor of Alabama. Mm-hmm. He never said anything like that. It's like you say, it was like a switch just flipped and Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde came out. That's the disparity between early Wallace and mid Wallace before the shooting.
That's kind of another parallel here. I was watching an opposition, ad against Trump. Mm-hmm. And, it was just like, it's showing and all of his different positions over the years. And as many people know, in up until
maybe two years ago,
he was more or less a urban Democrat.
Yeah,
I would say for the most part,
Democrat,
he was for single payer universal health care.
Still is, actually.
And he was, I mean, just all of these things, they showed him all. He was pro, I mean, I'm going to say it, pro abortion. I mean, not wanting people to have abortions, but wanting to keep the law, you know,
exactly.
Pro-choice.
Yeah, he's pro-choice.
You know, a lot of positions like that, described himself as a Democrat.
Yeah.
Even, and he's, you know, all these pictures of him smiling with Bill and Hillary. And of course, there's always that suspicion that maybe Bill put him up to it so Hillary would walk right in, you
it
know.
Might be. I mean, I'm really starting to think that that's what it is because I'm telling you, the Republican Party doesn't hate him because of his racism, sexism, and just ridiculous fascism. They hate him because he is a Democrat parading around as a Republican. That's why they hate him, because he doesn't exercise their values of traditionalism, conservatism. He's not a conservative. Not one bit. Well, and they hate that about him.
It reminds me of going to the Kentucky Derby once, and I was with this friend of mine, and we were going to play some little piddly bet, you know, and this guy goes, "Man, you know, these people really hate us because we screw up the odds."
Man, I'm telling you, if that comes out though in the 10 years that Bill Clinton put him up to this, Trump writes a tell all or Clinton writes a tell all, I'm telling you, like, I'm gonna come and I'm gonna make sure I get you the biggest, the greatest beer collection ever, because I'm like, Bill called it on the World Labor Hour.
Well, I wasn't the first person to think that up, I don't think, but, cause there's been people, well, there was like some big long phone call that Bill Clinton had with, Trump. Before Trump ran.
Oh, really? I
know. Oh, yeah. A real long phone call that's known about. And, but there's another thing too. Apparently, what I've read is that Trump had, three consultants monitor talk radio. Ooh. And basically what they were doing was recording what the callers were saying. You see, and what Trump is doing is taking what the caller, see, that's why they're out there saying, he says what I think, because he's just saying back to them what these people heard them say on talk radio.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. All right. We have somebody writing in saying, Trump's not a conservative. Trump is a libertine, a wild guy.
Yeah.
But I saw an evangelical, preacher, recently say that, Trump is a baby Christian. Well, folks, I think that
a
we
baby
should.
Christian.
Yes, a baby Christian. He's just starting out as a Christian.
So what? Okay.
I guess. I don't know. But that's going to be their excuse to support him. Well, folks, I think that we should probably cut out now. It's about 12:30. It's the bottom of the hour. Play a little music. Come back with some labor history and what's left of the union. Edge.